Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast about people, politics and pragmatism. In our last episode, we discussed the role of referendums in the UK. Here we're going to take a longer term view. We're going to be looking at how Europe has become such a bugbear for the Tory right. So in 1975, Margaret Thatcher posed in a jumper with all the flags of the European Economic Community member states on it to campaign for Britain's membership of the EEC. She signed a single European Act in 1985 and then was ousted by pro-European members of her own party 5 years later in 1990. And by 2002, Thatcher had completely recanted her view. She was warning of the perils of a European superstate. So, Steve Haynes, my partner in propaganda, does the changing stance of the Tory party just simply mirror the changing attitudes of Margaret Thatcher?
Oh, if only it were that simple, I feel like. Yeah. I think there's probably a bit of an element to that, certainly among the younger members of the conservative parliamentary party. There is actually almost a bit of a deification isn't quite the right word, but they're much more stridently Thatcherite than their the older generations were.
I suppose she won a lot of elections, didn't she? I mean, in the same way that Labour members worship Blair for winning. Oh, no, that's not right.
Yeah,
is it? No, sorry. Carry on.
I mean, when you compare some of the people that wrote Britannia Unchained, for instance, which is very much out of the Thatcherite playbook, these are people who are much more stridently on the outside of the EU referendum argument.
I love the fact that in Britannia Unchained, there's a reference in the index to Edward III, but there's no reference of Europe or the EU in the index at all, so Europe's completely off their agenda.
I'll be honest, I suspect there is something about Maggie Thatcher's views in terms of shaping the Tory party. I mean, you can't be as successful or divisive a leader as she was without kind of leaving a stamp. I think part of it may very well be the fact that, as you said, the people that deposed Maggie Thatcher were the pro-Europeans. They were the more kind of moderates. So I think it's linked to Thatcher, but I don't think it's people are just literally following her beck and call.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think you've also got situations like the fact that pro-Europeans like John Major and the failures around Black Wednesday and the ERM create a nice little kind of mythology around it. Throw in the euro and the issues that have arisen from that on the continent in terms of the economics of the situation, and you end up kind of I think the Tory right have just kind of built up this almost mythology around Europe and kind of its role in the problems that Britain faces. Some of it is actually accurate, some of it is completely poker.
Whereas actually it probably has more of a role in the fact the Tory party was out of power for about 18 years with the, as you say, with Maastricht, the fact that John Major then would call the anti-Europeans of members of his cabinet bastards, and Europe seems to play quite a big role in the Tory civil war that happens under New Labour as well, because I mean the best candidate for Tory leadership was Ken Clark, and the reason he didn't become Tory leader was because he was too pro-European.
For so many people, especially Clark, their positioning on Europe has kind of become their defining feature in terms of the internal party politics, which is bizarre in a lot of ways. I feel there are a number of people who are still relatively quite right wing, but are, you know, coming out as pro remaining in the EU.
I think William Hague is pro remaining.
Yes,
isn't he?
Yeah. I think one of the interesting things is that with the Tory right is the notion that Eurosceptic means you want to leave. Those Eurosceptic means sceptical of Europe.
Do you think that's an issue with the pro-EU people themselves, though, casting that argument? Because one of the books I've read, which has been really influential in how I've approached the referendum, is Chris Bickerton's book on the European Union. And that's one of the things that he talks about, is that if you express any opposition to the EU, you are cast as a Eurosceptic. If a German was to say they weren't really happy with how Angela Merkel was running the country, they wouldn't say that you were a German sceptic. He kind of says that it's only really Israel that's comparable to the EU, and that if you're
either pro or against.
Yeah.
There's no shades of grey.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually quite a fascinating thing, because the way this kind of debate has been framed, and I suspect part of this comes down to the way the media has kind of portrayed the arguments and the debate itself. Obviously, the vast majority of the papers in the UK are right-leaning, and are Eurosceptic. And I think the right-wing press have done a very good job of kind of framing that debate and kind of just pouncing on anybody who has kind of said something negative and portraying them as Eurosceptic. And then as a result of that, kind of saying clearly because they wanted to leave the EU in a lot of instances, them kind of going, well, if we criticise the EU and want to leave, they're criticising the EU, they must want to leave.
Mm.
And I think for so long, it didn't matter that framing was happening because, you know, if someone like David Cameron, for instance, would happily criticise the EU on a lot of different things, it didn't matter that he gets lumped in with Bill Cash.
In many ways, it probably made it easier for him to party manage, yeah, if he is.
It did. That's certainly the case.
I have a theory on Thatcher and the Single European Act and I suppose the fact that the Single European Act, it comes out of after 1974, that 1974 is probably quite a big turning point in the EU, well, the European communities it was. The growth in trade and the economic boom of the 50s kind of stops in 1974. You've kind of got the end of this first wave of integration. After that, you get a period of national stagnation in the 70s. A lot of this Single European Act, the aim of that was to say, well, we can't really do things at a national level as such now. We can't really do the central planning which we're doing before. So instead, we're going to try and have free trade instead and do some more kind of supranational things. She wants free trade. Obviously, she's very big on removing any barriers to free trade. And she kind of poo-poos the idea of there being any further integration as well. Maybe there's an underestimation there that leads to her downfall, which I think is quite interesting.
I mean, I think there's an interesting kind of counterpoint to that in terms of like the more modern situation where we face at the moment, where Gisela Stuart, who is one of the chairs for the Vote Leave campaign, a Labour MP for Birmingham Edgbaston, so one of the local MPs to us. She is, as I said, in favour of leaving the EU. She's gone from being Tony Blair's poster girl, because she's of German descent herself. So she is an actual European who is pro-Britain leaving the EU. And she said that the reason she's come to this conclusion is from having to work with the EU and within the EU. So I suspect that maybe with Maggie Thatcher, once she'd achieved the kind of the baseline of what she felt was necessary to actually get Britain stable and able to grow again, that maybe that after having to deal with the laws and the rest of the European leadership at the time, maybe that kind of experience soured her to kind of further kind of working with them. So much of kind of the way politics works is by actually down to the individuals involved. So if Maggie Thatcher didn't necessarily get on that well with the laws, then that sours the entire project, for instance. So much of the core kind of states that formed the EU to begin with, or the kind of the integration that would eventually become the EU, were obviously the ones which saw the brunt of the fighting in World War II. So for them, this wasn't just a case of we are trading, doing a thing for trade in the case of Britain. It's we're trying to avoid getting into this situation where we're ever at war again.
And I suppose there's that Cold War context as well, where they want to try and integrate Germany back into the fold rather than punish it after 1918. That's a really interesting point. I wonder if it's also kind of part of that is part of Thatcher's blinkered view of her own legacy, if I can put it like that, where, I mean, there's that famous speech in Bruges in 88 where she talks about how we didn't roll back the frontiers of the state in Britain to have them reimposed on the European level, which actually, if you think about a lot of what happens in Thatcher's Britain, where actually you do have an increase in centralisation, actually the parameters of the state, a lot of the law and justice, the security apparatus increases in the 80s, kind of the smashing of local democracy, things like the GLC. Actually, there's a lot of centralisation in Britain, in Thatcher's Britain, which happens at the EU level as well. So I wonder if it's a misremembering of her legacy. And I think amongst Thatcher Tory MPs now, who, as you say, they're more Thatcherite now, certainly
they're more Thatcherite than Thatcher.
Exactly. I think that's maybe the problem, is that Thatcher's misremembered as being this champion of individual liberty. Actually, in terms of allowing the frontiers of the state to roll back, in a lot of cases they increased.
Yeah, you know, people are remembering the deregulation, and as you say, but they're forgetting the centralisation.
Mm.
But I think they're also kind of assuming that it's the deregulation which led to, you know, the big boom and all that kind of stuff. focused on the fact that it was deregulation, and yes, we're free trade, but we're ignoring the main free trade bloc that we're a part of in that. Put a bit more kind of attention on that. Or if Maggie Thatcher had kind of paid a bit more attention to the context within which she was operating when she was remembering her legacy and kind of shaping this generation by her pronouncements at post her being leader, you probably end up in a very different situation.
I think it's also, I mean, coming back a little bit as well to what you were saying about Gisela Stuart and the prospect of the EU reforming, I mean, there's this paranoia that the EU is going to lead to this European superstate, which, I mean, quite simply isn't going to happen. It's not going to happen because the member states don't want it to happen. The EU can talk about all it likes, and I'm sure that Gisela Stuart probably got very frustrated at the bureaucracy, at this kind of blinkered view that we need more integration and that's the way to go. European leaders don't want it. Europe is a good place for European financial ministers or other ministers or leaders to go and thrash out deals and compromise in secret without worrying about how it looks in the press. But that does not mean that we're going to end up in this European superstate where we all have the euro and we have a European army. And I think there's a lot of paranoia. There's a lot of overestimation, both on the pro-European side who want to see more integration, and that kind of Thatcherite anti-EU side, which sees it as being rumbling inevitable. And it really isn't. It's all very overblown.
I think a certain amount of more integration is inevitable, just because you have you kind of have a financial union without a political union on some degree. To some degree, I mean, you know, just look at the problems that you've got with the euro, with Greece's finances and things like that. At the end of the day, that boils down to the wrong sort of integration occurred. Also, Greece lied about the state of their economy. Either way, they can't act in the way that's necessary without further integration or further separation. They're in a bit of a...
I think you'll see a bit of both. I think you'll probably see a two-tier Europe.
Yeah, no, I would agree. You probably will see a two-tier Europe. In theory, at least, the bare bones of that have already started to be created. Barely mentioned anymore, but Cameron's much talked about, much hyped up, and then much disparaged by the Leave side's renegotiation. One of the things was basically Britain gets a get-out clause written in there from further integration. If that is carried through, should we vote to remain, and we get that get-out clause and it's written into something, Britain can then go, no, we don't want that. That's too far, integration too far for us. You guys can do that. We'll stand over here.
And there's other examples as well. I mean, when Sweden joined the EU, I think it joined, I believe I'm right in saying, the early 90s. Really, Sweden should be joining the euro. There's no political will in Sweden for that to happen, I don't think. I don't think the EU's not going to force them to do it. It's just not going to happen. And I think that's if a country does not want that integration. As you say, Cameron's got his veto. Sweden not going to join the euro. Maybe there needs to be more integration for the euro, but that's... Again, probably the euro is a pretty stupid idea in the first place.
And I think part of the problem that Europe does have, and I think this is one of the reasons why Eurosceptics and kind of like the Leave side have been able to kind of make a bit of hay with this kind of, as you say, this almost sense of paranoia about that this is happening, is that they haven't, like, the EU hasn't actually come out and just said, you know what, this is where it's going. But they've been very, very kind of slow in responding to these kind of changing pressures in Europe across multiple nations in terms of like the role that the EU has. And indeed, the main kind of push for reform that has come about has been from like the European Parliament itself, where basically the different kind of coalitions of parties that form it up selected individuals who that should they get a majority within the within that parliament, those individuals would become, I don't know, president, or I can't remember what the actual official EU title is.
There's about five different presidents. Yeah. I don't think even they know which one's which.
But yeah, so you end up with the basically the parties within there nominating people as a way to try and increase democracy, increase kind of an engage with stuff. But the problem is, these people ended up kind of... the events happened in the last European elections, where you got the three different heads of these parties coming over to the UK in London, talking to, having debates and all that kind of stuff, doing everything that you should be doing. and yet nobody turned up to them because the only people who went to them were the people who were already engaged in Europe. Mm. There is a kind of a realization of this at the kind of the parliamentary level in Europe, but not at the commission level, or at least if there is, they're not acting on it in a visible way.
It's not surprising though, because I think from its inception, from the European coal and steel community, the European project has just been a series of practical solutions to practical problems. You know, it was countries went in at the first place for national interest. So I think in terms of that two-tier Europe, something will happen. It'll be more ad hoc and it won't probably please everyone, but I think they'll come to some sort of solution.
And I think that could actually be kind of an interesting kind of point you've made there, in that you said the EU is a practical solution. So my question then is, what is it trying to solve in the 21st century, or in the late 20th to the early 20th century, 21st century where we are now? Because I don't think Europe the EU quite knows what problem it's trying to solve at the moment. Mm. I think before it was really easy. It was, we are trying to kind of build out our economies after the war. We are trying to avoid war, make and fend off the USSR. Once that ends, once there is no other in that traditional kind of theoretical way for us to kind of focus on, what do we stand for? What are we actually focusing on in terms of our development and in terms of how we're going about kind of planning for change?
Mm.
And since you've got before the end of the Cold War, they don't have that focus, which means I think you end up more with these kind of ridiculous kind of, oh, you know, not that we ever have actually, you know, had regulation which limits the number of bananas you can buy in a bunch. You can see, but we have had some legislation like that, and it's because of that lack of focus from the Commission, because it doesn't know what problem it is trying to solve, where it's almost just, like all bureaucracies do, creating work for itself.
I slightly disagree just on the specific legislation. As I understand it, the reason why the legislation is so specific is so it can be enacted exactly in every single European country. And so everything needs to be stupidly in a lot of detail, so there's no question of interpretation.
Oh yeah, no, that's fine. But it's more the fact that why are they looking at those problems when those aren't the big problems that are facing Europe?
A lot of the change in Euroscepticism has happened because of the Cold War ending. I mean, before that, you had the most Euroscepticism was on the left, French, Italian communists, very anti-EU. They kind of saw it as the beginnings of American hegemony, all that kind of stuff. In the early 90s, around Maastricht, you have people like Bill Cash and Philippe Séguin, I think his name is, in France, who they're kind of oddball eccentrics. They're not really representative of their party. They're very well informed on the details of EU treaties, but they're not really a wider movement. And what's happened, I think, over the past 20 years is that Euroscepticism has become mainstream, but it's not so much them being anti-EU as such. But movements like the Front National in France, movements like UKIP or the Five Star Movement in Italy, they're more pissed off with national elites. I think they're annoyed with the political establishment in their own countries, not necessarily really with the EU. I think certainly the voters for those parties are more angry at national elites. It's not helping solve those problems, but a lot of the problems that those kind of right extremist populist movements have, the EU can't solve them. It's about the national countries, I think, rather than the EU.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and I think that kind of boils down to one of the reasons why the kind of, actually going back to what the kind of the core topic of the podcast is, one of the reasons that the Tories have kind of made it their bugbear. It's a really easy thing to make lay things to blame on. Quite difficult to do anything about it because it is a bureaucracy, because it is slow, because there are so many other moving parts in the form of every other single move.
I think especially if you look at immigration, I think too often we've just said, well, there's nothing we can do about it, it's the EU, which becomes a way of not talking about immigration.
Yes.
Just kicking the ball down the court. Then it doesn't become a political issue that we talk about. It becomes a matter of a legal issue, an interpretation issue.
Yeah, and I think that, again, kind of boils down to just the way that a lot of the discourse and the framing of, like, the EU stuff actually is made. If we do discuss these things, it's just with outrage that X, Y, and Z has passed, and it's a ridiculous, and they're coming to take away the British sausage. Yes, Minister, yes, Prime Minister. You know, that's not the case. The vast majority of the kind of the regulations which get passed from the EU. One, things that we've kind of actually exported to other countries anyway. An awful lot of the things like the health and safety, environmental welfare reforms have actually been things which started in the UK. The media and the Tory right have done a very good job of framing things in a very kind of outraged way. And because it's really easy to not put up a fight and just go, well, it's the EU, it doesn't matter. That's kind of led to a bit of a cycle of reinforcement where every time something ridiculous, quote unquote, happens, people just kind of go, oh, it's the EU, we can't do anything. And that just feeds that anger and feeds that resentment.
So I suppose summing up of why it's become the bugbear of the right, we can talk about how the Tory party is reflecting more facts from our view certainly than it was 15, 20 years ago. We could talk about maybe the mission creep of the EU and the fact it doesn't really have a concrete purpose.
I don't think it has a mission anymore.
No, well, I suppose it's just creep, maybe. And the fact that it kind of reflects our Eurosceptic media is quite a useful dividing line, especially when you've got a Labour Party that's quite pro-EU. I suppose my final question then would be, I've just started thinking about Nick Clegg, which isn't something that happens often nowadays. But obviously Nick Clegg is a probably classical liberal who did some work for Lord Carrington, for the Tory party in the 80s, but didn't feel he could join the Tories because of their stance on Europe and so joins the Liberal Democrats. If you were Nick Clegg today, if you were this aspiring, EU-loving kind of classical liberal Eurocrat, where would you join? Where would your home be?
And the Lib Dems probably are the best fit for that kind of people, and that's not just because Clegg's there. A while ago, there was a Tory MEP who defected to the Lib Dems. This was like a decade or so ago. Mm. He then lost his seat in the Great Rout, the first Great Lib Dem Rout, which left the Lib Dems only with Catherine Bearder in the European Parliament. The Lib Dems, for a classical liberal who's actually puts foreign policy and kind of like internationalism a big part of what their ideology is, you're probably looking more at the Lib Dems rather than the Tories. If you're a kind of a classical liberal who's not as focused on international stuff, or you're like your ideology doesn't necessarily reflect as much on that, then you know the Tories, it does work and it does fit. You can still be pro-EU, you can be Eurosceptic.
Perhaps. I think you're going to have even less kind of pro-EU voices than the Tories. I think certainly
moving forward from now,
I suppose we'll have to see. Next week, we'll be discussing European identity and what it means to be a European. But until then, goodbye.